Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. That song you hear in the background is Super Callous Fascist Racist Sexist Nazi POTUS, the ultimate political parody anthem by John D. Kundle. We'll hear a little more of it later on in the show. Tomorrow is Earth Day. And I'd like to close our show today by reading excerpts from an article by Tim Smedley entitled, Why I Hate Earth Day. We'll begin today with our Left in the Law folks, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, talking about the unprecedented assaults on our environmental protections. Following that, Luisa Martinez will be in conversation with immigration attorney and activist Daniel Canstrom about how the U.S. got here in terms of immigration policy and what can be done about it. You won't hear about stuff like this in the mainstream media, so if you can, please support Portland's alternative radio, volunteer-run and listener-supported. You can contribute by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. The current occupant of the White House would like to make America great again by destroying all regulatory barriers to resource extraction, like fossil fuels, timber, and mining. Never mind that these actions threaten the health and safety of our people and will greatly accelerate the rush to planetary ruin. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker survey the scene of impending environmental destruction and discuss why it might not be smooth sailing for the MAGA bros in the White House. Here's Left in the Law.
The Trump regime, guided by the Musk mantra of moving fast and breaking things, has dismantled many of the government programs, laws, and agencies that protect vulnerable groups as well as the environment. Musk's favorite prop in showcasing his Trump-anointed powers is the huge buzzsaw he likes to wave in the air. This menacing image takes on a quite literal significance as their sights are set on hacking and bulldozing their way through forests on federal lands, among other moves against the environment. So Mike, can you sum up or give us a bird's eye view of what the Trump regime is doing on the environmental front and where you see legal resistance to their strategy of dismantling every product of political progress, including around environmental protection?
Well, Trump is actually acting as the executive committee for the fossil fuel companies. The U.S. leads the world now, forget Saudi Arabia, in oil and gas production, exports, and expansion. And fossil fuel production and combustion are the core drivers of a global climate emergency. And they are now in power, and they've prepared for power, unlike the last time around with Trump. They are very ready. Trump has issued executive orders called the immediate resurgence of American energy, immediate direction for logging, and has as you said, eviscerated or eliminated federal programs, federal language removal, any language referring to climate change, which is an innocuous term to begin with, has been removed from federal agencies, knowledge removal, different bodies of knowledge collected by the NOAA about weather around the world have been eliminated. It's been a very systematic approach.
Yeah, even in terms of some of the language you were referencing around one of these White House papers, this one was unleashing American energy like it's a pit bull. And the aim is to unleash America's affordable and reliable energy and natural resources. There's nothing about renewable energy. It's all about natural resources, forests, land, water, that are seen as assets to boost U.S. military security and deliver what they call peace through strength. So there's a worldview behind this, a kind of new manifest destiny or revival of manifest destiny that is sending shudders around the world, actually. So how is this the assault on environmental protections different from these other fronts around immigration, education, you name a progressive development in the modern era, and they're attempting to get rid of it and get rid of the history of it.
That's right. That's exactly what they're trying to do. What's happened is in all these areas, well, some move more quickly than others. For example, immigration law is entirely within the executive branch. So that means that Trump can start right away firing immigration judges and replacing immigration attorneys and building a wall to keep people out. He can do a host of things right off the bat. He can do the same thing with tariffs. He's got lots of authority to act immediately in this area. But the environmental stuff is a different matter because it's being resisted. It's being resisted in courts all over the country. We've talked about his assault on environmental protections within several federal agencies, but he's also unleashed his favorite word, Attorney General Pam Bondi, to identify and stop the enforcement of state laws that address climate change and any environmental initiative.
Now, there's a different philosophy around states' rights operating here, right?
I mean, that's right.
The right wing has been all very big on states' rights throughout history. Of course, the South and fighting desegregating schools is one of the classic examples. Can they just kind of pick and choose around these things, or is there legal maneuvering involved?
Well, it's Trump's classic negotiation technique, which is to throw everything in the world up against the wall and see what sticks. I mean, he said, quote, these state laws and policies are fundamentally irreconcilable with my administration's objective to unleash America's energy. He wrote, they should not stand. Well, he doesn't have a thing to say about state laws. State laws have been powerful checks on environmental abuses. Just last month in the state of Washington, an initiative that encouraged natural gas use in the heating of homes was rejected by a judge who said the initiative here violates the Single Subject Act and should not have been on the ballot in the form that it was.
And it was a confusing and bad ballot measure, right?
Right. So the law governing initiatives and what language can be and can't be on them is particularly a state law concern. So this is a state law matter all the way. Trump's blustering can have no effect on this at all.
And but can't he do, you know, what has been happening with universities around the country and finally, you know, Harvard that had been not so praiseworthy around dealing with the Trump administration finally resisted and refused to comply. But the penalties are very severe, including with state schools like Portland State University, and their administrators are shuddering in fear, and some of it's lack of courage, but some of it has to do with the consequences of withdrawing federal funds. Is there anything similar to that around punishing states that refuse to comply with their right-wing, reactionary programs.
Well, sure, there are means and ways of punishing states available to the federal government, and Trump is using them against California and Oregon and Washington, and we can expect much more of that in the future.
What would be an example of that?
Withholding money, it's all about money. Like the Inflation Reduction Act included lots of money to set up programs of developing environmentally friendly neighbor solar energy panels and
And
stuff.
supporting low-income communities along these lines.
Yeah, along environmental lines. Well, he has tried to gut all funding of anything within the Inflation Reduction Act, which was actually quite a bit that had to do with the environment. But basically, state litigation and state laws are beyond his reach. So that's why there have been intense litigation, which we've talked about before, efforts by oil companies, fossil fuel companies, to move litigation out of state courts and over to federal courts, because their real power lies in their dominance of Washington, D.C., and both the legislature and the executive branch of government. And Trump is unable right now to reach that particular part of our judicial system.
Well, can you talk some about pressures on judges? Those have been center stage dramas. The most recent one, the judge elected in Wisconsin, even though Musk very actively tried to buy her opponent's election, and Wisconsin voters resoundingly defeated him, that campaign. That was quite heartening. But where else do you see pressures on judges and how this plays out, where many are responsive, like anybody in a job, to the pressures coming down on them.
Well, that is the area that concerns me the most about Trump and his regime. It's the one area that really is very strong indication of a fascist tendency. And I use that word advisedly, because what he's saying is that district court judges don't really matter. The only court that really matters is Supreme Court, which has my friends on it. He's violating the principle that has hitherto been followed by people whose values were exactly the same as those presently in power, like 20 or 30 years ago. But if they lost a lawsuit, they lost the lawsuit, and that was that. Now, Trump doesn't think a loss is really a loss. He doesn't think judges need to be followed. So he's really put heat on judges who have done things like restrict his action in the areas where he's first begun acting, namely immigration law.
Some of his name calling them scumbags and low IQ. I mean, talk about projection all over the place. But it's more than name calling. There are sticks and stones being thrown.
Of course, if he overplays his hand, which he's definitely done with tariffs, and which he may provoke the Supreme Court into checking him, at least in some ways. Of course, judges are not, as you said, immune to public pressure. If there are demonstrations in the streets, if there is general condemnation, like in the media and the press, all of that bolsters judges who are inclined to do the right thing. And environmental questions are more slowly addressed.
That has an upside and a downside to it. People become very impatient with the legal system in general and how slowly things move.
Yeah, it's much more slow. And I think the litigation, there is litigation, by the way, there is litigation on all these fronts. The executive branch of government is being sued in many states, in many federal courts, over many of the actions that we talked about that Trump has done. And these will be resolved eventually. There'll probably be evidentiary hearings eventually, but not now. But what happens eventually will be shaped by what's happening now. Whether Trump's regime is seen as just a grifter trying to do the same sort of pressure techniques he's used all his life of not paying off his subcontractors, of the kind of deceptions and muscling that he's always done. If that works, Well, that's going to intimidate free speech judges and jurors who are deciding these environmental cases. If it doesn't work, if his tariffs blow up in his face, if they make ordinary people have to pay much more money for the goods that they're now getting at a cheap price, and if the big money interests see the dollar continue to decline, if there are serious feedback from his base constituency, from the big money that supports him, from the media interests which he compulsively follows, whether he says respectful things about them or not. If there's pushback on all these fronts, that's going to make it easier for environmental lawsuits to prevail.
I think in seeking silver linings in a very dark sky, the country's going through a massive civics lesson on a very large scale. I mean, all of these agencies that work every day and do the difficult behind the scenes work around Social Security or any of the environmental issues that require scientists to study what's happening with the soil or the species that are vulnerable, or tracking community effects of the climate emergency. All of the people who do this work who are being just dismissed and devalued, and the work of so many people being devalued, even air traffic controllers. I mean, it's so blatantly regressive in the way they're operating and running this country. You have to do a lot of fancy mental work to have it make sense as far as anything humane or rational or in the interest of the well-being of everyday people. So if this is more apparent, of course, then it depends on what people do about it. And that's why mass mobilization, training and strategies of resistance are so important right now. And speaking of that, Earth Day is tomorrow. And there are a lot of national groups that are organizing, green groups organizing all out on Earth Day protests against Trump's authoritarianism and dismantling of critical environmental safeguards. But there's also a much longer horizon of protests we have to be thinking about, the importance of that and sustained and creative protesting, given how vulnerable a lot of these legal, the lawyers and judges are in these settings, which is an important front of resistance.
Well, yeah, their vulnerabilities are being exposed by Trump. And the truth is, the judiciary, designed to be separate and apart from the political process, is also influenced by public opinion and by the political process, if not directly, then indirectly. So all the kind of activity you're describing not only can influence the executive branch of government immediately, but can determine who gets elected to office and will have an influence on judges. And judges are going to be called upon to do things that they're not used to doing, to really condemning executive orders that they've been used to tolerating. But we live in completely different times. The whole notion of science, for example, is being redefined by Trump, who's getting rid of grants by the National Institute of Health on the basis that they're politically designed. It's a resurrection of like the Soviet Union's Lysenko in 1930s and 40s, Stalin's favorite scientist, who was convinced that the evolutionary process would allow things that you've learned to be passed on to your children. And this idea was something supported so ferociously that it led to Russian science being dismantled and Russian scientists being killed who insisted or thought in some way that the evolution didn't work like that. So now we've got scientific health studies being cut off because the people who are applying them or some sort of language within it would imply that the program of ultimate white male supremacy is not being followed here. And as a result, scientists are leaving. Not only are Chinese-trained scientists returning to China, but people are going to Canada and Europe. Scientists are seriously reconsidering their career because of the lack of funding and the distortion of what they're trying to do. So we need to be louder and more vigilant and more energetic in opposing this than we've ever been before. Is there are possible good things that will result from the end of the quote rules-based international order with the United States at its center, which has prevailed in the world since 1945.
Trump may very well be the symptom of its bloated status and ultimate decline, not as healthy as he claims. The country's not going to be great again as he promises, right?
Right, man.
Okay. Well, Mike, we'll have to continue to follow not only the horror show we're all living, but and that has deep and long roots, this being the current and most extreme manifestation, but the potential and ongoing resistances to it. This is Jan Hocken talking today with Mike Snedeker on The Left and the Law about Trump and assaults on the environment.
Lord, come down and help us out. Send us an angel, help us out. SOS, help us out. Looking all around and watching the world.
People killing, people dying, people lying, people blind. People don't see the sign, watching money all the time. Get the pennies, get the dimes, get the dollars is the mind. State of the human race, people on a paper chase. The environment is fragile, and we've been on the gradual. Declining in a lifetime, or lose the battle. Get burned by volcanoes, get blown by tornadoes. Cause Mother Nature signals is trying to warn NATO. We got a new terror threat, it's called the weather. More deadlier than chemical and nuclear together. It's hotter in the winter, even hotter in the summer. Jesus or Buddha, somebody come and help us out.
Lord, come down and help us out.
That music was from the song SOS Mother Nature by Will I Am. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussed the current attack on our environmental protections. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The appalling use of immigration policy to make America safe for white Christian nationalists might be shocking, but it is not new. Luisa Martinez recently sat down with immigration lawyer and activist Daniel Canstrum for a wide-ranging discussion about the history, ideology, and political economy of immigration in the United States. In part one, which you are about to hear, they take up the political economy of labor migration, the historical antecedents of current U.S. immigration policy, and the racialization of immigration enforcement. In part two, which will air next week on April 28th, they take up immigration policy through the lenses of gender, poverty, and ideology. Daniel Canstrum is professor of law at Boston University and has decades of experience with immigration law. He is the author of Deportation Nation, Outsiders in American History, and Aftermath, Deportation Law in the New American Diaspora. Luisa Martinez is a member of Portland DSA and the National Political Committee of DSA. Due to insurmountable editing challenges, at least to me, this interview begins abruptly with a discussion about the complex politics of immigration in Mexico. The first voice you hear is Daniel Canstrum.
You know, in Mexico in particular, you know, there's such a strong sense of historical pride in that country. There's such a powerful sense of what it means to be from there. And on this side of the border, the idea is they're all just sort of like desperate people who have no culture, and they, all they want is to make some money, and or else, you know, worse than that, some people think they're all criminals or whatever. But the more Mexico has ascended in the last, let's say, couple of decades, economically, as you say, which is clearly true, two things have happened. One is that there has definitely been less Mexican economic migration than there ever had been before, there's still a fair number of people seeking asylum because Mexico has problems, serious problems with corruption and violence also. But those numbers have gone down. But the other thing that's happened is that Mexico has developed a pretty robust deportation system of its own for Guatemalans and Hondurans and other people coming north. So I've been working on a book in which I've been looking at that. When I first started writing the book, I thought the main story was that Mexico had been enlisted by the United States as an agent of its own exclusion and deportation policies, because the whole push, this is going back to the Obama administration, in some ways even before that, the whole idea was to push it away so that they didn't have to deal with it here. They didn't have to deal with the moral consequences and the legal consequences. But as I looked into it, I saw that was true. I mean, they were giving money, drug enforcement money, anti-terrorism money, all kinds of money, which was then being used to stop people on the roads coming north or stop them even at the Guatemala border sometimes. But also a lot of Mexicans supported that. And, you know, there were Mexicans in Tijuana who began to resist some of the migrant communities that were coming there. So these problems are kind of in some way like eternal and in some ways universal and in other ways really, really specific. Like, I mean, Chile, for example, is another example. Chile was very welcoming to Haitians after the earthquake, you know, in 2010. And Chile has a long history of a relatively open model, as does, for example, Ecuador and some other countries in South America. But recently, I don't know if you know this, but a lot of the Haitians who were coming up during the Biden administration, who were coming crossing the Darien Gap and coming north, I would see them being arrested. Remember, there was that famous incident with the CBP guy on the horseback who was whipping people and all that. And I heard some of those Haitian migrants being detained speaking Spanish. Now, I grew up representing Haitians. I mean, when I first started in my legal career, many of my clients were from Haiti. And in fact, I had family in Haiti when I was a kid. So I've known a lot of Haitians in my life, and almost none of them speak Spanish. The ones who speak Spanish might have been the ones who had been deported from the Dominican Republic. You know, there was movement that way. But then I realized that a lot of these Haitians had been living in Chile for a decade. And then they were forced out by the government of Chile and by economic downturns in that country. And that's why they were coming north. So, you know, sometimes it can get really, really specific.
What are the economic reasons for all of these types of migrations? And how is enforcement, what drives that and for what reason? So,
yeah, well, so ironically, both the right and the left tend to agree on this, that in terms of viewing, let's say, global migration generically as largely motivated by economic factors. The question is how you view those economic factors. I tend towards the left view, of course, and particularly in this hemisphere, you can't speak coherently about emigration and migration in the Western hemisphere to the United States without looking at the history of economic imperialism, exploitation. You know, there's both political and economic factors. I mean, people are fleeing Guatemala because it's an unstable government and there's violence, but there's also, and there's great poverty. And you can trace a lot of that back to overthrowing the government in 1954, which the United States did. So you can't talk about these things absent some understanding of that. In Mexico, you know, various initiatives over the years have really harmed the Mexican economy, particularly in terms of things like agricultural production and so forth. And so people lost their land, they lost the opportunity to make lives where they could. And there's also a long history of recruiting workers to this country. So then the question is, what function does the border serve in that scenario? And obviously, it serves a function of keeping people precarious and keeping people subject to manipulation and exploitation. You know, in Marxist terms, you could call it a reserve labor force, or you could call it a lot of different things. But there's no doubt, this is why I use the phrase post-entry social control to in my first book, to talk about what function does deportation serve. Well, it's a mechanism for the government, but also the government as in partnership with agribusiness, for example, in certain parts of the country, or meat packers in other parts of the country, or people in the Hamptons. There was just a piece in the Times yesterday about how the people in the Hamptons need a certain kind of labor force. They need to keep that labor force available and pliable and docile and not able to unionize easily. You know, that's a large part of the story. It's not the only part of the story, but it is certainly a major part of the story. And I think you see that everywhere in the world. There's never an issue of people migrating from wealthier countries to poorer countries. It's always the other way around. And then the question is, how much responsibility do the wealthier countries have, not only to be humane towards the migrants, but also to recognize that a lot of the causes of that migration actually also explain the relative wealth of the country to which the people are migrating.
What is your perspective on arguments back and forth on whether or not immigrant labor depresses wages for native born people?
Yeah, that's an interesting debate. And there is some evidence, of course, that if you have a large reserve pool of workers who are willing to work for less money because they either come from a country in which they can't make anywhere near that amount of money anyway, so they're willing to work harder for less money, that is going to put some downward pressure on wages for workers in the country to which they're coming. It's also going to hinder unionization efforts. This is why, the owners of the, let's call it the means of production, if you want to use Marxist terms, I'm happy to do it, are quite comfortable having a large pool of, again, controllable, precarious, docile workers who, if they act out, can simply be deported. You know, that of course, that's going to lower wage gains. And this accounts for why American labor unions have historically had a very fraught relationship with migrant workers going back to, you know, the 19th century. Chinese workers were coming in and they were willing to work harder and cheaper and to be exploited. I mean, willing is always a questionable word in this context, but they were subject to being exploited more than U.S. workers were, who were forming labor unions on the West Coast in particular. And so those workers tended to be the vanguard of anti-immigrant sentiment a lot of times. And this is why sometimes the strongest supporters of immigration have been the wealthy or the companies that want their labor. So those of us who think about immigration tend to want to think about it in more than simply economic terms. But on the other hand, there is a counter story, which is that if the workers can stay in the country to which they come and have children, particularly in this country where their children would be U.S. citizens by birth under the 14th Amendment, not under Trump's executive order, but I think that executive order is wrong. I mean, incorrect and morally wrong and legally incorrect. Now, although the Supreme Court may differ with me on this, then what happens is there's a lot of studies that show that immigrant children, the first generation, are enormously productive and benefit the economy. And so immigration is always a revitalizing force in any country in which it is allowed to flourish. So there's a sort of ironic potential or a dialectic there, if you will. My own feeling is that immigration is almost always a net benefit to any country, as long as those people have rights, as long as those people are treated with dignity and respect over time. It always works out because those people work harder because they feel like, they also commit less crime. There's a lot of good studies that show that the being a citizen is a much greater predictor of criminality than being a non-citizen. Non-citizens tend to commit less crimes, they work harder, and they benefit the economy. There's also benefits to the economy even for undocumented workers who have to often have Social Security and other taxes taken out of their paychecks. And then if they get deported, they never see that money. So even among the exploited workers, if they're on the books at all, which most of them are, but many of them aren't, it's not as if they're not paying into the, you know, the tax systems and so forth of the country. So I don't think economic arguments actually get you to a resting point in terms of how you feel about immigration. Again, I think you have to be a little more specific about particular situations to assess whether it's a net benefit or not. But in general, my own feeling is to be supportive of immigration. I think it tends to benefit both the migrants themselves, which is a economic and a moral point, and the country to which they come. Although if you have large waves of uncontrolled migration due to, you know, some sort of a, you know, natural disaster or a war, then that does put pressure on the country to which people are coming, and that can then breed xenophobic reactions, not usually grounded so much in economics as in other things, you know, fear and xenophobia and so forth.
So what of the argument that immigrant populations serve a purpose, particularly in cities and states where the population historically has been dying?
Well, that, I mean, Germany recognized this pretty quickly. Japan is recognizing it. Korea is recognizing it. The United States, it hasn't been so much a public discourse. But yeah, immigration is the is a classic solution to the graying of the population. And this population decline is a really serious issue in a lot of countries around the world. And it accounts for a certain increasing openness to certain forms of immigration. Now, again, there's always a debate about who do we want. You know, part of the reason that Germany was so open to some of the people who were fleeing Syria and Iraq was that a lot of them were quite well educated and actually could plug into the German economy in ways that it was clear that they were needed. When you start talking about large numbers of relatively poor or very poor people with relatively little education, then the debates tend to be more visceral about that. But their labor is needed too, at least for the moment. Now, all of this has to be bracketed by what AI and technological developments are going to do to certain labor markets. I've heard conflicting studies of this, and I'm not an economist and I'm not a futurist, so it's hard to predict. But in general, there certainly are examples around the world of many countries that are starting to think we need to open up to immigration a little bit because we're not having enough children.
Can you explain the most, what you feel are the most important historical precursors to the modern day deportation system, starting before like Chinese exclusion and where we typically start when we discuss these types of things?
I mean, I think first of all, it's a little bit artificial, although I did it myself. It's a little bit artificial to separate out the deportation system from the exclusion system and from the general regulation of migration. But since I was looking at deportation in the first book that I wrote, and your question focuses on it, let's be clear that what we're talking about is the history of the development of a system in the United States that takes the bodies of non-citizens who have arrived here and then compels them to leave. And it could be back to the country they were born in or the country they just came from, or as we're seeing now, actually to any other country that's willing to take them. So that's deportation, the forced movement of a non-citizen out of US territory. And in order to figure out the roots of that, you have to kind of break it into some pieces and think, what is that? What is the root of the idea that the government has the power to remove anybody from this country? Well, for that, you have to start asking, what is the root of the idea that people who have citizenship are different from people who don't have citizenship? Because there's very little history of the government of this country forcing citizens to go anywhere else. Most people would say that that's unconstitutional, although there's nothing in the Constitution that specifically prohibits it, but it's unusual. I mean, you could see a case of extradition or something where a U.S. citizen might have committed a crime in another country, the other country wants them, the U.S. government could force that person to go, but there's a lot of process and it's very specific. So I started thinking or researching, like, what is the history of the idea of distinguishing people who were born here or had citizenship from people who don't? And this precedes the Constitution. It long precedes the 14th Amendment. This goes back to English common law, that there was an idea that if you were born in the territory, you were subject to the sovereign, you were subject to the ruler. And if you were not, you were subject to being asked a lot of questions if you showed up. And so even in the colonial days, if somebody was born in Providence, Rhode Island, and they wanted to move to Boston, Massachusetts, certainly if they were born outside the United States, but even if they had been born outside of Massachusetts, there were regimes in place on the level of cities and states to question people and make sure that they had money. And there are some good studies that have shown even then that there was great differences in enforcement if the person on the move was a woman or was a person of color or was indigenous, versus if it was a white man who seemed to have property and money. So I thought functionally that was kind of interesting to me, but the specific history of this system probably begins the specific legal history with the so-called Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790 period, which is, you know, soon after the Constitution. So deportation was integral to the evolution of the US government. And in that time, there was a concern about the French, that they were undercutting, they were too revolutionary. You know, the New England Federalists were really afraid of French ideology deriving from the French Revolution taking root in this country. And so they passed a law through the Congress that gave the president the authority to remove anyone who he deemed dangerous to the peace and security of this country. A remarkable law, if you think about it, to give that much discretionary power to John Adams, who was the president. And he, of course, was then asked to delegate it just to his Secretary of State, who said, I'll figure out the people. And they did go after a few people and they did deport some people. But it immediately provoked a really powerful backlash. Thomas Jefferson in particular opposed it very strongly, James Madison. And then Jefferson was elected president in 1800. So cases challenging these laws never made it into the courts. So we have some history of an experiment. In fact, Jefferson called it a radical experiment. But by the time he got elected, largely with the support of Irish immigrants, by the way, in New York, the law just was not enforced anymore after 1800 and parts of its sunset. Parts of it are still on the books, by the way. There's a law called the Alien Enemies Act that goes all the way back to that. But the more controversial one was the Alien Friends Act, which dealt with people who come from countries with whom we are not at war. So that was a federal law. But what happened after that is that the states continued to take it up. And New York had its own deportation policy and migration policy. Massachusetts had its own. Of course, many of the current states were not states yet. But what we saw was a gradual process of federalization of these kinds of things. And in that period, I started thinking or asking what was similar. And the main thing that was similar to deportation were the fugitive slave laws, which transcended individual states and gave the government, the federal government, basically the power to arrest people who had been, or to authorize the arrest of people, slaves, freed slaves, who had been deemed to be non-citizens, and then to send them back to slavery. And that, you know, those laws were terrible and they were much resisted. But I thought that sort of got the concept in place that the federal government could remove the bodies of certain people and send them back even to, you know, bad places on the grounds that they were not citizens. It wasn't that they had committed a crime, it was just that they were not citizens, and therefore they had no right to residence in, for example, Massachusetts or New York. In addition to that, Andrew Jackson around this time and others, you know, they started forcibly removing indigenous people from their lands. So much of the removal, for example, of the Cherokee looks like a massive deportation episode if you put it into more modern terms. I mean, you could also, of course, call it ethnic cleansing or genocide. I think those would be apt terms for it. But basically, again, it was the federal government using its power to remove the bodies of people who were considered not to be citizens. And of course, there was still sort of an open question whether indigenous Native American people who were born on this territory were citizens under the Constitution. And that didn't get resolved for many, many years. It's pretty well accepted now, certainly in statutory law. So the main thing that really begins the deportation system as we know it is the Chinese exclusion laws and the Chinese deportation laws of the late 19th century. That's, you know, sort of a rough outline of the story. And I want to say that in all these historical periods, there were always debates about this, not only about whether it was the right or the wrong thing to do, not only about whether it was a racist and oppressive thing to do, but but about whether the federal government actually had the power to do this, to arrest people. You know, like, where, what was this power? There's nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government shall have the power to arrest people. Or even for that matter, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government the power to control immigration. The only thing in the Constitution that speaks to this is a grant of authority to Congress to create a uniform rule of naturalization. So the courts had to really struggle and ask questions about, where does this power come from? And does it have any limits? I mean, can they just round up anybody they want and remove them? How do they prove it? And so that's where lawyers like me have come in over the generations to say how, you know, how we should look at this and what the limits of that power should be.
So you kind of opened the door regarding the racialization of how these laws have been determined.
First of all, let me just affirm what you just said, which is that you cannot understand the deportation system of the United States, and probably of almost any other country, without looking at race as a factor. Likewise, gender, and certainly poverty, and also ideology, but particularly race. I mean, the contribution of critical race studies to understanding deportation in particular has been, you know, really profound. And I don't even know how anybody can argue against this, because the very first major federal immigration deportation law is grounded in something called the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the case is called the Chinese Exclusion Case. So it's explicitly race-based. And certainly the history of enforcement has always been race-based. And there can be little doubt about that. I mean, the current laws are not expressly race-based, except when you get into immigration policy and you see how the quota systems have functioned over the years, and, you know, all these questions become certainly intermeshed with racism in ways that really cannot be denied. So whether you want to call it critical race studies or just looking at the facts as they unfolded, I think the truth of it is pretty apparent. And this, again, is why I was drawn to the fugitive slave laws and the Native American Indian removal laws as antecedents to deportation, because they weren't called deportations. They were not formally considered to be exercises of federal sovereign immigration power. But I thought that functionally, they look a lot like the same thing. And one thing that they have in common is the imposition of majoritarian race-based power against what we would call in other areas of the law a discrete and insular minority group, that is to say, particular people of color who bear the brunt of these kind of laws. So I thought, well, that's interesting. It looks pretty similar. So whether you want to call it immigration or deportation, functionally, it's quite similar. In more recent years, of course, you know, you have things like the roundup of Japanese people in the World War II period. Clearly, I mean, you could debate whether this is based on nationality, based on ethnicity, or based on race. And those categories overlap. But it's certainly based on those kinds of things, immutable physical and cultural and heritage-based characteristics of people. Of course, in the Japanese case, it also got to a point where even citizenship was not a protection. Actually, Jefferson made the same point in 1798. He said, the friendless alien has been selected as the subject of an experiment, but the citizen will soon follow. And part of my own concerns about deportation is that it creates habits of mind that governments can then often expand to US citizens. So people think citizenship is a total protection against deportation. That is technically true, but it is not inconceivable. And in fact, it happened in the last Trump administration and could happen in this Trump administration, that they start looking at distinguishing naturalized citizens from born citizens, that they start asking questions of people, how actually did you get your citizenship? That they start trying to deny citizenship to the children of naturalized citizens or to the children of permanent residents. I mean, once you start parsing these things, you can see that there have been examples in history of deportation forming a framework in order to go after citizens. I mean, your readers will probably be familiar with the Emma Goldman case. Emma Goldman, you know, was a very well-known activist, you know, anarchist figure of the early 20th century. She was a U.S. citizen. I mean, the first thing that happened to her was that she was denaturalized because the government argued that her citizenship had been obtained by virtue of a fraudulent marriage. And then she was deported.
My children, why do we build a wall? Why do we build a wall? We build a wall to keep us free. That's why we build a wall. We build a wall to keep us free. How does a wall keep us free? My children, my children, how does a wall keep us free? Out the enemy, and we build a wall to keep us free. That's why we build a wall. We build a wall to keep us free.
The music you just heard was Anais Mitchell with her song Why We Build the Wall. Before that, Luisa Martinez was speaking with Daniel Canstrom about U.S. immigration policy. Tune in next Monday morning for part two of their discussion. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We only have one day out of 365 to celebrate the planet that we are slowly killing. But that's not all. Earth Day has become a handy opportunity for corporations to greenwash and for businesses to profit off of so-called Earth Day product sales. Environmental writer Tim Smedley argues that we ought to be paying more attention to Earth Overshoot Day, the day of the year on which humanity's annual demand for natural resources and ecological services exceeds what the Earth can regenerate in that same year. Ideally, Earth Overshoot Day would be December 31st. Last year, it was August 1st. As your well-read read, I am going to read excerpts from the article by Tim Smedley entitled Why I Hate Earth Day by an Environmental Writer. It was published online in The New Climate on April 19, 2023, where the complete article can be accessed. For children and activists of the 1970s, Tim Smedley begins, the original Earth Day was a necessary and seismic moment, but that was then. Now, Earth Day seems tokenistic, patronizing, and pathetically minimal given the scale of the challenges we face. I hate it, because rather than one day that could turn things around as was originally intended, its annual hypocrisy simply shows us how screwed we truly are. We don't edge ever further to a solution on each and every Earth Day. We edge ever closer to the precipice. Here's a taste of the press releases that clutter my inbox as an environmental writer in the run-up to Earth Day. Quote, as we approach World Earth Day, I wanted to see if you would be interested in featuring Triple X. Triple X is a planet-conscious marketplace that offers quality products, bamboo, upcycled, as well as regenerative brands. End quote. In other words, happy Earth Day. Now buy more stuff that you don't really need and destroy the planet further. Earth Day is also the perfect day for greenwashing. The bank Santander, for example, issued a glowing press release full of wind turbines, trees, and sunshine, exhorting, quote, events like Earth Day are a time to make individual and collective commitments to preserve ecosystems, use natural resources responsibly, and fight climate change and other disasters. Earth Day is for everyone, end quote. But wait, what's this? The Good Shopping Guide to Ethical Banks and Building Societies states that Santander was criticized by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism for its $800 million shares in JBS, the biggest meat company in the world, which has links to Amazon deforestation. And according to BankTrack, since 2016, Santander provided $23 billion in lending and underwriting to 100 key companies expanding the fossil fuel industry. So Earth Day really is for everyone, including deforesters and the oil and gas industry. The real Earth Day that we should all be made aware of is Earth Overshoot Day. This is the date when humanity's annual demand for natural resources and ecological services exceeds what the Earth can regenerate in that same year. Ideally, Earth Overshoot Day would be on December 31st. The first calculated overshoot day came shortly after the first Earth Day. There was cause for concern. It fell on the 25th of December, 1971, meaning that the world was using up the replenishable quantities of the Earth's resources several days before the end of the year. This was a wake-up call, and the world needed to act to ensure that this didn't happen again. Instead, we used up more and more and more. Earth Overshoot Day in 2023 was August 2nd. In 2024, it was August 1st. Now, after over 50 Earth Days and Overshoot Days, our decline is so great that we use up resources as if we live on 1.75 planet Earths, but we only live on one. So forgive me if I'm not in the mood to join in the Earth Day quote-unquote celebrations, and forgive me if I don't buy your sodding bamboo pillowcase. I just read excerpts from an article entitled Why I Hate Earth Day by Tim Smedley. A link to the full article can be found on the page for this episode of The Old Mole at kboo.fm. That's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank moles Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, and occasional mole Luisa Martinez for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest Daniel Canstrom. A shout out of gratitude as well for the hardworking staff at KBOO, your community radio station. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. I'm going to leave you with more of that delicious song by John D. Kundel, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, the ultimate political parody anthem. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and above all, stay active.
A sequel, he'd have nailed this guy, or maybe Mel Brooks if he were high. His fans believe he's heaven sent to drain a murky swamp, but all he's done is fill it up with cronies on a romp. He'll gas a crowd for photo ops and blame the ones who kneel while donors cheer and lobby near to cut a better deal. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, misinform and gaslight till the nation's in hypnosis. Try to say it backwards just like facts, he won't oppose it. Despising sick, 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 sick